All right, straight into it this week because I've got a heap of stuff to cover and I know these videos are getting long. Not intentionally, there's just a lot of stuff. So, starting at the beginning, I was going to do this one next to my coffee machine. I know it sounds like a strange thing. Someone said you should do this at the coffee machine's change of environment, and apparently a lot of people like coffee. Coffee machine's broken, which has really been a terrible time to have the coffee machine broken as well, given that it's kind of fuel for the sort of stuff we do. So I'm going to do that another time. But bear this in mind, there's a lot of other stuff that's been happening this week that I want to get into. And looking at my list, that the first thing I want to cover here, and I'm super, super stoked about this, my httpseasy.com website and the four associated videos, so this is the 4 5-minute videos about how to make HTTPS just super, super, super ridiculously easy. A bunch of people have been translating it into other languages. They've been contributing closed captions. Now, I didn't know that you could do this until someone pointed me to it a week ago or something. And the bit I didn't know you could do is I didn't know you could open it up to community contributions so that other people could come and add translations. And in fact, the first person that did it said, look, I would like to do English closed captions because the ones that YouTube can generate are kind of terrible. It turns out computers aren't real good at understanding Australian accents. So she did, She didn't do a translation. She just transcribed it into English closed captions. Now, then after that, I think I tweeted about it and said, hey, look, thank you very much. I think it was Deborah who did this. Thank you very much, Deborah. A bunch of people then went, we should do this in other languages. So here are the languages we now have closed captions in for some, if not all, of the 4 videos. English, Dutch, German, Norwegian, Finnish, Italian, Czech, Polish, Indonesian, French, Swedish, Danish, Spanish, Slovenian, Russian, and Greek. 16 different languages with closed captions. If your language is not on there and you would like to contribute, I will put a link in the blog post that goes along with this video or podcast about how to do community contributions. Loads of people who've never done them before have been doing them, I know, because I've sent them the link about how to do it. And just in case I forget, if you Google YouTube community contribution closed caption, you'll find it straight away. So this is super, super awesome. I love the sort of meta-ness of more people contributing to make HTTPS more accessible to, I don't know, maybe it's not meta, but you get the point. I love the idea of people wanting to make the whole premise of this site more available to more people than ever. A few people have asked about translating the website itself at httpseasy.com. That is not easy. So it's not like YouTube where there's a built-in construct to do it. I would have to build localization into the website and then manage the contributions from people manually. And frankly, all the value is in the videos. Plus, I would assume, tell me if I'm wrong, people who speak other languages, but I would assume that Google Chrome can do the same with English to whatever it is that you speak, just like it can when I go to a foreign language website and it says, would you like to translate? So frankly, I think the value is in the videos themselves. Thank you very much to all the people that have contributed. So that is awesome. Now, another thing that sort of came to mind just during this week, and I actually got a little bit behind in this, but I'll give you a bit of an overview of what I was thinking, is it feels like every day there's another breach or 2 breaches or like how many? There's always something crazy going on. So I started noting these down just because I thought it was really interesting, and then I kind of got busy. But the ones I noted down, and there is actually one in particular I want to talk about here. We had Domain Factory. So this is a website in Germany that got owned. Now, I don't have a reference to this, but one thing that just popped into my mind, apparently somewhere when they were doing GDPR compliance stuff, they were adding a checkbox or an agreement or a field or something else. And as part of adding the GDPR compliance piece, they unfortunately ended up disclosing rather a lot of stuff that they shouldn't have done. Code bug by the sound of it. I'm just looking at the story here in ZDNet, and I'll link to these as well. User data exposed in Domain Factory Hosting security breach. That's a bit of a wordy term there. So site in Germany. Incidentally, Germany, based on my experience at least, tends to be the most privacy-conscious country in the world. You know, we think of Europe as being a very privacy-conscious region, which is very true. Germany in particular has got really, really strict privacy laws, more so than anywhere else I can think of off the top of my head. So not good for those guys. Now, another one here that was very interesting, Polar Fitness. And the story here in Engadget talks about Polar, so you know, like the heart rate monitors and things. The problem with Polar seems to be that a bunch of people using this, and we had a similar issue with another fitness tracker earlier on in the year. I can't remember if it was Garmin or Fitbit or something like that. But you got a bunch of military personnel using these things, and it's tracking their activities around places like bases in Iraq or other areas where you don't really want to see the comings and goings of people in defense capacities. It was Strava. I've just noticed here in the Engadget story. It was Strava. This is the problem. We've sort of got these devices which are by design meant to collect data. And then, of course, it's the modern era, so we've got to sort of socially share it everywhere. So they're collecting all this information, sharing it. And, of course, that is valuable intelligence, you would imagine, for someone who wants to know where people are coming and going and what times they're coming and going at a military facility. So how defense forces actually allow these devices is kind of a little bit beyond me. I'm sure they have many rules about things you can and cannot do on a base like that. You would think that one of them would be not to share your comings and goings with the world via fitness trackers. So that was Polar. Now there's another one here that I thought was particularly interesting for a reason I'm going to talk about in a moment, which is TimeHop. Now TimeHop has had themselves a data breach, unfortunately, and what's really interesting here is their disclosure. Now, I've got a disclosure message here I want to run through. Now, this was sent to me by someone on Twitter. They probably don't mind me saying their name, but I won't because they haven't explicitly said it. But I think I'm going to ask them if they don't mind if I take this disclosure message and write a blog post about it, because it is epic. Now, what I mean by epic is it is massive. There's a huge amount of stuff in here. And in fact, I will make sure I link to a tweet that shows you just how big it is. But the things like it goes, well, actually, let me start off. Because one of the first things these guys say, and this is a little thing, but I personally think it's important. They say, first off, we would like to unequivocally apologize to our users for this incident. Now, I like this. This is ownership, right? This is saying, look, we had an issue. We're taking responsibility for it. We're going to see it through. We're not just going to blame the hackers. Now, conversely, I've got to find this other one. This is really crazy Australian. Here we go. Really crazy Australian hosting provider. Australian. I'm just making a note of this to make sure I put it in the notes. Crazy hosting situation in, I think it was in Perth in Australia, which is the other side of the country to us. And they've had a data breach. It looks like someone has nuked all of their backups as well, which of course tells you something about whether they're using off-site backups or not. They've basically blamed the whole thing on cyber terrorists. It's just a really, really badly worded disclosure. In fact, maybe that's what I'll do. I'll do a blog post that sort of juxtaposes these two. And, you know, here's how it's done terribly. It was the hackers, their evil cyber terrorism, yada, yada, yada. In fact, I did a search and I think there were like 4 references to cyber, 3 of terrorist and 0 of sorry. You know, it's kind of like, well, you're not handling this very well. But anyway, back to TimeHop. So TimeHop went through and they've got a table in this email with things like all the classes of data and how many records were there and the number of GDPR records. We've got to understand what they mean by GDPR, that they might just be talking about folks from the EU. So for example, they say, look, there were name, email address, date of birth, 13.6 million records. So that's substantial. 2.2 million were breached GDPR records. And then they go through email addresses, total gender designations, phone numbers. They've got a heap of info here. They've got very, very clear titles. What is next for users? This is what you should do about phone number security. What happened? How has TimeHop responded? What are all these terms and what do they mean? And they've got definitions for things like attacker, compromise, exposure, breach, network intrusion, key, frequently asked questions. And they go on and on and on. And then they've got all these classes of data again that explain what they've actually stored and what that means for them. So for example, they've got one here. They said, look, we store the Facebook user ID. the face, and then they've got a plain English description of what this is. This is actually the name of the title. So for Facebook, it says, the user ID associated with the user. This has been deprecated in this table and is public information. So if anything, I almost kind of wonder if this is sort of over communicating just a little bit. Like if I was a mere mortal, not a techie like us, and I got this email and I looked at it, I'd be going, holy shit, like where do you even start interpreting this? But I think this is actually a really, really good end result in terms of transparency. And I know that everyone that's commented on this has said, wow, look at this. Like, okay, something bad happens. We know bad things happen. But haven't they done a great job of communicating this? And this is where I think the goalposts have moved to with data breaches now. And what I mean by this is that what I'm seeing is sort of a shift in sentiment where people are now less upset about the fact a breach happened, and they're judging an organization more on the way they handled it. Now, I came to this sort of conclusion, must have been about November last year, just when I was heading off to do the Congress thing. And the penny that sort of dropped for me was when the Uber incident came to light. And people were smashing Uber. They're like, you know, this is terrible. And rightly so. I mean, they covered up an extortion attempt for all intents and purposes. And of course, that was after Equifax, which had all sorts of dramas. But it was also not long after the Disqus data breach came to light and the Imgur data breach came to light. And in both those cases, from the time I disclosed those incidents to them to the time that they communicated publicly and notified everyone was like 24 hours. And it was transparent. It was done well. And I was just seeing this constant sort of scenario of people doing data breach disclosure very, very badly and just being slammed for it, and those doing it well and people going, well, this is just life on the internet. So sign of the times, I think. I should actually take these two and put them next to each other. Another one, Macy's and Bloomingdale's. So apparently Macy's and Bloomingdale's, Bloomingdale's in the US has had an issue here as well. They're notifying customers of data breach involving unauthorized access to their payment card data and personal information. And then I got really busy and I just wasn't really tracking many more after that. But you see the point, right? Like, it is just a constant flow of incidents. Interestingly, and I won't give too much context to this, I'm doing some training next month for an organization in Sydney. And I was speaking to them yesterday, and they just had a competing organization have a rather public bad data breach incident. And when I was speaking to them, I was saying, you know, look, just out of curiosity, how much did that incident of your competitor influence your decision to come and have me spend 2 days doing a workshop? And they're like, yeah, it's a big thing. So think about the discussion that these guys I'm going to see would have been having with their leadership when they're like, look, we would like to take, yeah, I don't know, 20 or 30 people away from productive work for 2 days, which is where the real cost of these events are. It's taking people away from actually building working software they can sell. We'd like to take them away for 2 days and do security things. And it's incidents like this that are driving this. Unfortunately, the folks that are actually conscious enough to do something about it are still a tiny fraction of the overall internet population, at least in my experience. All right, so that was that. Now, another interesting thing as well, pwned passwords. I'm going to talk more about pwned passwords in just a moment. But I had a little note here. Because Stefan from EVE Online, so I've spoken about EVE Online a few times before. EVE Online, the massive online multiplayer game, they implemented pwned passwords quite early. They were one of the first organizations to do it in a fairly serious scale. And whenever anyone goes and logs on at the moment, it checks their password against pwned passwords to see if it's been previously breached. And they've really gone all in on this, and they've been very public about how they're doing it, and also being very public about their results and the performance and everything. I caught up with Stefan in Oslo last month. He came to my workshop for a couple of days. We went and had a lot of beers and things like this, which is what we do after the workshops. And it was really interesting to sort of hear about how they're integrating the service and the experience they're finding. Now, they're continually looking at how do we sort of tweak our messaging, like how, for example, how forceful should we be if someone logs in with a pwned password? Should we force them to change it? Should we warn them? Like, what should we do? He put a poll out during the week. He said, poll and brainstorming time. If we detect that a user has a pwned password, according to Have I Been Pwned, and is therefore an easier target in the event of a breach, should we, and then this is the poll options. Number one, should we nag the user on every login? Number two, should we force a password reset as soon as possible? Number three, should we auto-reset password in X days? Number five, something else, comment. Now, one of the criticisms that I've heard of pwned passwords, and I definitely see where people are coming from with this, is that there is a usability impact. And the usability impact is if someone, let's say in Eve Online's case, if someone's logging in and you say, no, sorry, you can't log in because your password's crap, you've got to go and change it. That is a barrier to entry to the service. That could be detrimental for trying to increase adoption of the service. It could be a negative experience for the person. You've got to be cautious that you don't create the impression that your service is the one that's had a problem. So I totally see the perspective of people that are cautious about using pwned passwords in this way. I expected this poll to, I guess, be sympathetic to the usability side of things. And in fact, it was quite the opposite. So here's the end result. So 24% of people said nag user on every login. So basically just keep saying, you've got to change it, got to change it. 58% of people said force a password reset as soon as possible. Now, this really surprised me because between these two, what are we at? We're at 82% of respondents effectively said you've got to make the person change the password. If not now, then on a subsequent login until they just get driven nuts and they do it anyway. Only 5% said something else. And that really, really surprised me. Now, I'm conscious also that you know, Stefan's shared it. Obviously, I've retweeted it. This is from 1,852 votes as well. It's a reasonable, substantially large sample size. It's probably an audience that's a little bit more security conscious, so maybe the results are a bit biased, but I didn't expect them to be that biased. So very interested to see that. We'll have to sort of see how other organizations handle this as well, but the leaning towards, look, just don't let people use it at all is, it kind of surprised me. So anyway, moving on. Let me talk about blog posts now. So this is where things got a little bit busy this week. On Tuesday, I loaded a credential stuffing list referred to as PemiBlanc. And I said that with my worst French Australian accent because it was on a French server as well. And this was 111 million records in a credential stuffing list. Now, just to recap, this premise of credential stuffing is attacker says, I'm going to take a great big list of usernames and passwords, which are normally email addresses and passwords, that people have used from various other websites that have then appeared in various other data breaches. It's going to get me a great big list, and I'm going to take them and try and log into all sorts of other services with them. And I know that I can do this for a bunch of them because people reuse their passwords. We all know this. We know they shouldn't. This is life. It's just the way it is now. So credential stuffing attacks prey on the fact that people do reuse their passwords across multiple services. Now, so long as that service, which they're trying to test, enables the attacker to do this, and this is where part of the nuance is, because if there's enough defenses in there, it starts to make it very, very difficult. But then there's other issues and things that we'll go into another time. Point being is that we get a lot of these big lists. So for example, in Have I Been Pwned last year, I loaded the anti-public and exploit IN list. They were more than a billion records together. Put them in the database. On Tuesday, I did the PemiBlanc list. Now, it was about 94% of the email addresses had been seen before, which on the one hand is a very, very high hit rate for a data breach, which would imply that a lot of this data has come from other sources already in Have I Been Pwned. But by the same token, there were more than 6 million email addresses I had never seen before, which are now in Have I Been Pwned. Now, I probably should have seen this coming. I knew this was going to come. I probably should have thought through the process a bit more. But inevitably, a lot of people said, what's my password? You know, like, what password did I use? And what they're really trying to do is they're trying to drive towards what is the action that I now need to take. So for example, was it some cat forum somewhere and I need to go and change that password? Now, that's a very, very reasonable response. A lot of people said, yeah, show me the password. Well, I'm not going to store your password next to your account in plain text and make it available. There were people that do get, what's the right word? Very passionate about this. They're like, look, it's been breached anyway, just store it. So I'm not going to go around on the one hand doing all these workshops about how to secure your systems and proper ways to store passwords, and then on the other hand go, yeah, here's 111 million of them in plain text sitting there. Like, that's just never going to happen. So having said that, I'm sympathetic to why people are asking about this, because they want to have enough information to know what to do next. Now, I'm going to talk about how this feeds into Pwn passwords in just a moment, but one of the things I need to put into context here is that when we look at these credential stuffing lists, they're pretty much always terrible passwords. Now, there are a couple of reasons for this. One of the reasons is that most of the data breaches we see today do have some form of cryptographic hashing, even if it's just MD5, which is terrible, let's face it. But there is something. It's rare to see a system breach today where data is stored in plain text. Still happens. Not arguing this. Still happens. Now, the thing is that let's just say it's MD5. If you've got a good password, and what I mean by a good password is not your dog's name. I mean, not unless you have a very unique dog. I mean something like a randomly generated string from your password manager. If you have that, make it 30, 40 random characters or something, even in MD5, it's not getting cracked. Ergo, when I look at these lists and there are passwords which are clearly almost exclusively weak, being cracked out of systems that have had some sort of cryptographic storage, LinkedIn is a perfect example. LinkedIn was SHA-1. There's a heap of LinkedIn cracked passwords. If you're using password manager, randomly generated string, it's not going to be in that list. If the password was stored in plain text in this service, it's not going to be a major service of any importance. You're not going to see, for argument's sake, Facebook gets breached tomorrow and all their passwords come out. They're not in plain text. They're not in plain text in anything of significance and importance today. And I am, of course, making some assumptions about this, but I'm basing it on the data breaches which I see day in and day out. So what that means is it's probably not going to be an important service. Plus, if you've got a unique password, and you should have a unique password on everything, then even if it was a service that, you know, you don't want someone logging in and commenting on your cats, it's only going to be the cat forum service. So I guess my point is that if you're using proper account management hygiene, it's not really going to be a problem anyway. But I do appreciate the sentiment. So the penny that dropped, and this is what I should have thought about earlier on, is that Pwn passwords is, of course, the perfect channel to solve this problem. Because I can say to people, look, I'm not going to give you your plain text password for your account anywhere in Have I Been Pwned, but I will load it independently out of the context of any account as part of Pwn passwords, and then you can go to Pwn passwords and see if it's in there. Particularly if you're using something like 1Password that allows you to search your entire vault in one go, all you have to do is if I put those passwords into Pwn passwords, you go into your vault, you go into Watchtower, you go, hey, check all my passwords, it rips through the whole lot, comes back and tells you which ones have been seen before. So if you then had a new hit, you'd know that's a bad password and you'd know which service you used it on, unless you're reusing it, in which case you've got different problems anyway. We've already covered that. So I fast-tracked Pwn passwords version 3, which now leads us into the next thing, which is the next blog post. And I want to talk about some numbers here as well. So Pwn passwords is something that I just keep adding to as new data appears. So there'll be a new breach somewhere or a new credential stuffing list. I will take those passwords and I'll add them in. And I'm adding, let's say for argument's sake, a new list every couple of weeks. And over time it gradually increases and I continue to build up this list. And my assumption was that it would get to sort of a critical mass. It would get large enough where I'd go, there's enough new stuff in here, I'll do a new release. Now, version 1 was 320 million, version 2 was 502 million, and I didn't have a number in mind for version 3, I just figured it would feel right when it got there. Now, because of the Pemiblong thing, I decided to fast-track version 3. I had actually been tweeting about it. In fact, I think I mentioned it in the video only last week. So look, I think we're getting towards a V3. I fast-tracked it because of this, which is why my week kind of blew out. The week I didn't have the coffee machine. So in total, there are about 18 million new passwords. And I'm just going to check my numbers here because I know people like to hold me to account if I get anything wrong. Where's the actual numbers? Okay, so in total, there were 15.6 million new passwords in V3 over V2. That is a very small increase proportionately because it's only just over 3%. One of the things we need to understand, though, is that because of the prevalence of password reuse, there's like a law of diminishing returns as there's more and more and more data breaches going into this system. Because what will happen, let's say tomorrow, someone turns around, they have a data breach, there's 100 million passwords in there. There's going to be a significant portion of those which are already in V3, which is now up to... passwords must be up to about 517 million. Yeah, that's who we're at. So in raw numbers, 517 million passwords. I just realized I tweeted an incorrect stat before, and I remember why I tweeted an incorrect stat now. I actually flagged a bunch of passwords in V2. I flagged a bunch of them as junk. And the reason I flagged them as junk is I found a whole bunch of parsing errors, which just included things it shouldn't have. So, you know, no dramas really in terms of checking if your password was actually in there. It's just that you could have checked other junk and that other junk might have returned a hit too. That's why I looked a little bit lost there. So the correct number is 517 million, of which 15.6 million came from V3 alone. So this is the thing. As we get more and more and more data in there, new corpuses increase it by a smaller amount. So in V3, in fact, I'll just read this sentence because it makes sense in context. In all, just the new V3 data had 194 million total passwords in it. So what's actually happened here is this 194 million total passwords has distilled down to only 15.6 million that I haven't seen before. So you see this sort of diminishing returns thing. So be that as it may, I've loaded this data in. What this means is a few things. So number one, it's changed the counts on the existing passwords. So an example here is that in V2, the most popular password, which believe it or not is 123456, most popular password had been seen 20.7 million times. In V3, it's still the most popular password, but now that count has been up to 22.3 million. So what we're seeing here is an adjustment in the counts. Plus, of course, there's the 15.6 million additional records which have gone into the system, which means that if you're, say, using the API and you're doing the hash search, your average result is going to go from something like 476 results per hash range search to now 495, roughly speaking. So it's going to obviously be about 3% higher per the figures. So the APIs are going to return slightly more data. I have also created, added a last modified header. And I added the last modified header because I want people to be able to see if they're getting V1 or V2. So if you're getting a last modified header of about Feb, you're getting V2. If you're getting a last modified header of the last couple of days, you are getting V3. Now, this is important because of caching. So I do really, really aggressive caching at Cloudflare. I did flush all of the cache after reloading the data today, after loading the V3 data. And incidentally, when I loaded V3, I've got all of V2 sitting in one blob storage account. I loaded all of V3 into another blob storage account and then just flicked where the API was pointing to. So I could always roll back if I needed to as well. So I managed to do one clean rollover. The other thing that happened, I'm going to look at my figures here, is when I flushed cache, I was a little bit worried about this, if I'm honest, because something like 94% of requests to pwn passwords get served directly from Cloudflare cache, which means they don't hit my Azure functions back end. Now, the bit I was worried about is if I suddenly flush all of cache, I'm going to go from only like 6% of requests going through to the origin to initially at least 100% of requests, which is going to be a lot. Now, I'm having a look at the stats here as I rolled over. In fact, there's an interesting little thing that's... No, this is actually what I was after. Interesting thing that... I got up real early. Interesting thing that's changed here. If I look at the last... I can look at the last 4 hours. It was just over 4 hours ago I rolled over. So what I'm actually seeing here on the Azure end is somewhere around, I was getting somewhere between 600 and 1,000 requests a minute to the Origin website before. And then as I've rolled over, it's peaked all the way up to about 6,000 requests to the Origin website. Now, what I love about this is that when I look at the stats in Azure, it's just constantly around 20 milliseconds execution time. In fact, it's slightly slower many, many hours after flushing cache. And when I say slightly slower, the slowest average minute looks like it's been 30 milliseconds, which is good. My 50th percentile for the last 4 hours is 19 milliseconds. The 99th percentile is 73 milliseconds. Happy with that as an absolute outlier. So bottom line is that Azure Functions has actually scaled beautifully. It just hasn't missed a beat. It's just going to hit my bottom line, hit my pocket a little bit. But, you know, like, let's be honest, I've spent more on coffee today than what that's actually going to cost me in terms of what hits my bottom line. So now what will happen is it'll just take a while for the Cloudflare cache to rebuild. My cache hit ratio will be way down, but over time it will come back up. Okay, so we've added the last modified header, flushed the Cloudflare cache, all the new stuff's going through. There's also the downloadable files. So there are two downloadable files with all the data. One is sorted by the hash itself. So we're going to start with lots of zeros and we're going to end with lots of Fs. And there'll be 517 million rows in there. Now that one is fine. That's up there. It's downloadable directly as a file, which Cloudflare really aggressively caches. So it was effectively downloading from Cloudflare. There's also a torrent, which has already been extensively torrented. There was, at the time of recording, there was a file you could download that ordered by count. So the worst password first, 123456, all the way through down to the least worst. I don't want to say best. The one that had been seen the least frequently. The reason why it's not there anymore is because the 7-zip file got corrupted on my end. And the only way I figured that out was when someone emailed me. And... look, in the scheme of things, if this is the worst that happens out of this rollover, which I did do pretty hastily, I'm pretty happy. But unfortunately, it meant that some people would have downloaded this sort of 10 gigabyte file and then gone, oh, I can't open it. So look, I really apologize to anyone who did do that. I screwed that up. I did verify this by opening up the 7-zip. And in fact, I could open the 7-zip and I could see the contents. It was only when I started extracting it that the corruption exposed itself. So I've removed those links from the Have I Been Pwned website. This machine over here, my P50 Lenovo with all the Xeon processors and gigabytes of RAM, is churning away very, very loudly at the moment, trying to re-archive that. It takes about 2 hours to 7-zip a 22 gigabyte file, incidentally. But it does compress it all the way down to about 10. So obviously that makes a big difference. So anyway, I've got to let that happen, and then I've got to upload it over the Australian internet. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to tether it to 4G and just pay for the bandwidth just to try and get up there quickly, because I do feel kind of bad that I screwed that up. So that'll have obviously have a new SHA-1 hash for the file. I'll create a new torrent. By the time you see this video, it will be up there and it will be live, and this will all be a distant memory, and we'll forget it ever happened. Cool. So that was Pwned Passwords. I hope everyone keeps getting use out of that. Incidentally, you'll see right at the start of the blog post, there's a chart from Cloudflare that shows the total requests over the prior 24 hours was 10,133,138. That is a new 24-hour record for Pwned Passwords. I clocked that in as I was writing this blog post, I think, night before last. So that is just massive. It's just continually growing and growing and growing. And thank you, everyone, who is using that and supporting it. Also, that rollover, I spoke about the Azure stats going right up. As best I can tell, it was completely seamless. So frankly, the fact that the worst that happened is I screwed up a 7-zip file, is not too bad. Looks completely seamless. I will pull the Cloudflare stats on that later and just see if it worked well. But this was effectively publishing to an Azure Functions app in a staging slot and then just switching slots. I've got a blog post I've pretty much finished about this as well. So hopefully that'll go out next week. All right, moving on. Something totally different. Static sites and HTTPS. All righty. Now, so I've had many discussions on this weekly update video on Twitter and my blog about HTTPS, and obviously I'm a proponent, I think it's fair to say, of HTTPS. I think we should be using it everywhere we possibly can, and it does wonderful things. All the security things are evident, as well as the performance things like access to HTTP2, access to Brotli compression. It's just a really good time to be using HTTPS. And of course, the whole HTTPS is easy thing about, hey, it's actually a 5-minute job for most websites. I want to put that caveat in there because I've had people pop up and go, have you seen how hard it was for Stack Overflow to move to HTTPS? That's like a top 200 website. Like, this is not a normal thing. The interesting thing is that when you think about that HTTPS is easy video, the sites that it works easiest for are things like personal blogs, like my blog, which is using exactly the implementation in that video, and like the blogs of people that are vehemently complaining about using it. And this is what I find really interesting. Like, if there are people popping up, say it was someone responsible for HTTPS at Stack Overflow, and they popped up and said, look, it's really hard. Yeah, here are the issues. And incidentally, Nick Craver has written about this before as well. If you Google Nick Craver Stack Overflow HTTPS, there's some really, really awesome content there. But if it was someone running a complex site, or even a site with like loads of external dependencies, and maybe they don't support HTTPS, or maybe it changes other things in the implementation if they just whack it behind Cloudflare, I'd get that. But the people complaining about it are the ones that have the most basic, simple, static websites. Now, that leads us to one of the discussions that's been going over and over and over again, which is effectively, this is just a static website. There's no passwords, there's no credit cards, there's nothing sensitive on there. I don't need HTTPS. And this is not a good argument. So what I've typically done is I've pointed people to, does my site need HTTPS or not? If you go to .com. So if you go to doesmysiteneedhttps.com, it says yes. And then it explains it very, very carefully. So for example, it says, there's a heading here. There's nothing sensitive on my site anyway. I'm going to read this para because it's really, really good context. Your site is a liability. Just because your site is hosted safely in your account doesn't mean it won't travel through cables and boxes controlled by who knows how many corporate and state-owned entities. Do you really want someone injecting scripts, images, or ad content into your page so that it looks like you put them there? Or changing the words on your page? Now, frankly, I think a lot of people don't actually care too much about that, but the other bits they should. Or using your site to attack other sites. This stuff happens on airlines a lot, and again, these are linked. In China, even ISPs do it a lot, and HTTPS prevents it all. It guarantees content integrity and the ability to detect tampering. If we encrypt only secret content, then we automatically paint a target on those transmissions. Keep which of your transmission contains secret by... I think they've got a typo in here. Anyway, they're saying encrypt all the things. Now, often online, there are robust debates about these things where people very, very vehemently hold a position of not, in this case, needing HTTPS. And last week, I participated in one such robust debate. And I want to be very, very clear here that this is not about one site. Like, there are lots of people having either robustly having this debate or very legitimately asking the question. You know, like they haven't had the discussions that you and I metaphorically had about all the value proposition of HTTPS. And they're saying, do I need it? Anyway, I had a discussion last week with a bloke called Jacob. And Jacob was talking to a bunch of us, sort of having this same discussion about, do I actually need it on a static site? And he felt he didn't. And it sort of got to the point where I said, look, well, you know, can we use your site for a demonstration? And I want to make it clear that I checked sort of multiple times directly and through replies to others that he was okay for this to be a demonstration. And he does actually say, go and try to hack my static blog for which I thanked him very much. And then he backed that up with other comments to other people, all those links from the blog post. So we now have a static site, which is a perfect example. And I don't want to sort of make it clear. I am genuinely appreciative to Jacob for offering this site because it's the perfect example, because it is just a basic static site. He writes some articles on there the same way many static sites do. He has no user collection. He's certainly not taking credit card details. He's probably not that fussed if someone changes the words on his site, but there are other attacks. So what I really wanted to do was to create a video that just chained together a whole bunch of things. Just like bam, 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 bam. Here are all the reasons. Have a look at what I can do to your static site if I can control the traffic. So there's a bit of an intro where I talk about different sorts of threats. You know, man in the middle at airlines, hotels, Wi-Fi pineapples, state-sponsored stuff. I give lots of examples of where these things have happened. Let's establish that it is something that is possible, and here are all the places it can happen. One of the things I realized, actually, there's a good argument here. I realized as I was doing this piece, and I did actually record this into the video, is that nobody that I see arguing for not needing it on a static site is arguing that you don't need it on your bank or your Gmail. They believe that you do need it on those classes of site. Now, that is an acknowledgement that traffic does get intercepted. So they wouldn't want to log into their bank if they didn't see HTTPS. They wouldn't want to do that because they're worried about someone getting into the middle of the traffic. So we kind of got to separate the issues where we go, okay, everyone, even the folks sitting on static sites, acknowledge that man-in-the-middle attacks happen. Okay, put that in the box, agree on that. Next bit now is, now that we all agree on that, let's have a look at what the man-in-the-middle can do. And then you have to decide whether that's a problem or not. So what I do here is, look, I've tried to make it sort of equal parts entertainment value and education. And this is sort of consistent with all of the talks I do and things like this as well. I want people to enjoy watching this. I want them to get a bit of a laugh out of it, but I want them to take away something very serious as well. So I start off by putting Clippy on there. Everyone remembers Clippy. We love Clippy. So I get a bit of Clippy on there, do some cornification as well. If you're not sure what cornification is, if you like unicorns, you will love this. It is, in fact, cornified.com. It is the site that allows you to embed unicorns on your site, followed by a bit of Harlem Shake. Now, Harlem Shake actually has a serious angle to it insofar as there is a JavaScript library. I guess it's a library now. A bunch of JavaScript, which embeds MP3 and CSS, and it makes the page starts animating elements so that they shake, and it sort of does it to the beat of the Harlem Shake song. And the serious aspect to this is that this is often used as a proof to demonstrate a successful XSS attack. So in the blog post, I actually reference the fact that someone did a great proof where they showed how you could put, you could listen to this carefully, you could put XSS in the TXT entry of a DNS record and then look it up on a Whois service that doesn't properly output in code and effectively get XSS on the Whois service. It's totally awesome. I linked to that on the blog post. We've also seen it used by, in fact, the first time I saw it used by a guy called Brenno de Winter. He was a Dutch journo. I saw him do this about 3 years ago in Amsterdam on Dutch banks, to sort of show that here's all these Dutch banks with vulnerabilities. Isn't this funny? They're all dancing to the Harlem Shake. So I put a bit of that on the static site. And then we get into the serious stuff. And it's things like crypto miners. And I reference a post in here as well. In fact, there was a story from the Tor project just the other day about Egyptian ISPs inevitably at the bequest of the government embedding things like crypto miners into HTTP pages. So that certainly happens there. Of course, we've seen crypto miners embedded through things like, remember the BrowseLoud situation, modifying an external JS dependency that other websites have to pull CoinHive, which is the crypto miner of choice, into these other sites. If you can man in the middle of the traffic, you can put a crypto miner in there. So I whack a crypto miner in there, drag over the CPU usage, show that it's gone crazy. There are nasty things like router CSRF exploits. So there are a heap of routers out there, particularly this sort of mainstream consumer-grade stuff that never gets patched, with CSRF risks. If you can trick someone's browser into making a post request that is, particularly if it's unauthenticated, so you don't have to be logged onto the router, and if the router doesn't have any anti-forgery tokens or other CSRF defenses, then you can possibly do things like change the DNS settings. If you can change the DNS settings, you can make name resolution happen on a malicious server so that when you go to a site like btlr.com, which is the one I use in this demo, you can redirect it to a site like scripting.com. If you don't know the context of that, I'm not going to go into it here. You can go back through the archives. So I do effectively DNS hijacking and say, hey, look, you're seeing one website here in the URL, but you're getting a totally different site in there. Now, onto more serious things again. China's great canon. Chinese government, turns out, is not so happy about some of the projects that are running on GitHub. Back in 2015, they did a massive man-in-the-middle attack against Baidu, which is effectively China's version of Google. And when external requests, so requests outside of China, were made for Baidu over HTTP, incidentally, Baidu is still the world's number one website that doesn't have HTTPS, not by default. It's there, but they just don't enforce it. So when people were going to Baidu, the outbound gateways in China were adding in this malicious script, which would then effectively weaponize all of the browsers of people browsing to Baidu so that they just massively DDoSed GitHub for two particular projects. One was the Great Firewall project, or Great Fire project, I think, and the other one was the Chinese New York Times. So I grabbed that script, I put it in here, and it's like, look, I've just loaded my browser. It's now telling me there's malicious script on there. Incidentally, man in the middle gives me the ability to put script on there, even though there wasn't script there before. That probably sounds obvious to you, but I've seen people arguing that my site doesn't have JavaScript, therefore I don't need HTTPS. Not so. And then the big one, and this is the big one in terms of what I hope is a really impactful demo, is Beef, the browser exploitation framework. Now, I've used Beef in a bunch of other demos in the past as well, and this is a super, super cool project where you only need to get one line of JavaScript on a victim's website, and it's a hook. So you literally embed a file called hook.js. Now, you can embed this if you're a man in the middle, because you can just add this as the site loads. You can also embed it via cross-site scripting. You could also embed it if you manage to do something like the browse allowed situation again, where you can modify external JS that then gets loaded. Bottom line is, there are multiple ways to get the hook on the target browser. Once the hook is on the target browser, Beef has like this control panel where you've now got control of a whole bunch of things that happen in the browser. Now, what I mean by that is, what you can do is say, I would like to start pushing things to the browser. So if you look at the network tools in the browser, you'll see it continually polls this hook.js. So you're in the control panel of Beef, you're seeing the IP address of the browser, and you're like, I'd like to push them a flash update. And then suddenly on the page, this window pops up, says flash update. And I show this in the video, and then if you click on the flash update, it loads a malicious file. So, you know, here we are, a normal everyday static website, and because the traffic wasn't protected and it was modified, I'm now serving you malware. I also show how you can push a phishing page, and it pushes a very, very convincing looking Google logon page. So you're literally there on this website, and keep in mind as well, that may not be the tab that's in focus. You might be somewhere else. And down here on this other tab, suddenly the page has been changed to have a Google phishing page. You fill in the login credentials because you're like, hey, I'm on Google, I should be logging in, and the credentials get sent to Beef. Now, of course, this relies on someone not looking at the URL and going, hey, I don't have HTTPS and I'm not on a Google domain, but people are notoriously bad at doing those things. And in fact, this is sort of one of the underlying principles. Because people are so bad, not you and I, but like the masses of people, because they're so bad at looking for this stuff, we need to protect them from themselves. And this is why things like HTTPS are so important. So look, I wrap it up by saying, in fact, I show a bunch of tweets of people that have gone and done the HTTPS is easy thing and said, hey, this is awesome. I've just added this to my blog for free, or I've done it in, one guy said I've done it in 10 minutes. And 10 minutes is a long time for this exercise too. You can do it much faster than that. So I sort of got to the point where I was like, well, why wouldn't you? Here's all the reasons why you should. What reason have you got left why you shouldn't? And frankly, I can't think of any good ones for sites like this. I hope this becomes somewhat of a canonical resource for people asking the question, does my static site need HTTPS? We'll see. I literally just published that and then went and did this video, so I'm not even sure what the feedback is like yet, but I really hope this gets a lot of traction And again, a genuine thank you to Jacob for that. I appreciate his offer, and I hope that that he is one of the people that goes to HTTPS. Okay, so that is all the things for this week. Last bit is NetSparker is sponsoring my blog this week. I have spoken a lot about NetSparker before. That is a product that I've used for many, many years. It's really nice to have a sponsor on there that that not only is a company who is doing good stuff, but one that I'm endorsed in and have used many times before. So big thank you to those guys. I'm going to have to start planning my 2019 a little bit sooner than usual, I think. And hopefully they're one of the guys who will still see around there many times next year as well. Thank you very much for watching this. Please do leave comments on the website if you have any feedback. I genuinely don't tend to engage on the YouTube comments because look at a lot of the YouTube comments. So come to my blog and leave comments if you've got anything else to say. Thank you very much. I will see you from home next week, hopefully next to a working coffee machine. See you, everyone.